The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, Rosamund Pike discusses the dark arts of scene stealing as she stars alongside Paul Giamatti in Barney's Version. And released this week is a reboot of a British classic, Brighton Rock. I'll be discussing the new version with two of its stars, Sam Riley and Andrea Risborough. And Zan Brooks joins me to review some of the week's other releases, including Oscar-nominated Nicole Kidman in Rabbit Hole, Oscar-nominated Christian Bale and Mark Wahlberg in The Fighter, and prettier than all of them, Nanette the orangutan as Nanette. Yes, it's the caged beast of the podcast world. It's Film Weekly.
Who's been asking questions?
I'm the Rana Pinkay. She runs Snows. She said Fred Hale was a gentleman friend.
What did you tell her?
I told her I'd never seen Fred Hale before. I don't think I should go back to Snows.
No, of course you go back. If you quit Snows now, it'll look bad. Besides, Fred Hale died natural.
You said he was mixed up with the mob.
Sam Riley as Pinky and Andrea Risborough as Rose in a clifftop scene from the new Brighton Rock, originally a Graham Greene novel and a 1947 film starring Richard Attenborough as Pinky, now an established icon of British genre cinema. So, debut director Rowan Joffe is a brave man indeed in taking on such a sacred text, and the risk for actors is surely just as great. To find out more, I went to meet Sam Riley, who found fame playing a pop icon Ian Curtis in Control, and now steps into Lord Attenborough's shoes, and Andrea Risborough, one of our fastest rising actresses. Pinky and Rose certainly have a tumultuous relationship on screen, but I remarked, they seem remarkably relaxed together now.
Yes, it's nice.
Yes, no, it, yeah, is, yeah. It is a stark contrast, if that makes any sense at all. Yeah, but it's also a very long time ago in a way, because you make a movie and then it takes such a long time to edit and to come to fruition.
Yeah. And the relationship that you do have is so strong, and I mean it kind of is powerful. It's more powerful than I'd remembered. You know, when I saw the original film, which is being re-released on remastered, looks amazing. But your version is sort of more tempestuous.
Well, that's great, Jason. Thanks very much.
We're glad you think that.
Was that the idea? Because you have got such a thing to live up to. Was that the idea to sort of, where can you take it and do something?
The thing is that it's kind of different for us, because we didn't, I mean, really, in terms of the film, we had nothing to live up to because we weren't remaking the film. But we were retelling the tale in a different historical context. Yeah. So that we really had the book to live up to more than anything, didn't we?
It's pretty torrid in the book, isn't it? As well, from what I can remember.
Yes.
And also, there is a thing that you're more modern than the characters, both in the book and the original film, that your characters are 60s characters. Did that give you a bit more of a sort of modern take on them, that they were going to be slightly more, I suppose, youthful?
In some ways, I mean, it still works being in the 60s, because there's still the death penalty and the bookies opening and things like that. And youth, there were still young men and women that were capable of being that as innocent as they both are, even though it's an odd innocence Pinky has. He's still, and they're both sheltered from things and sort of awakening to the adult world around them, which was happening in Brighton at around the same time, you know, the youth rebellions and uprisings and things.
Because childhood is such a relatively recent concept anyway, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's a Victorian concept. This time, I suppose, was quite pivotal historically, because it was, I know that my family, you know, went to work when they were 14 and 15. That was kind of a very normal thing, that you didn't really, teenagers weren't really, they were just beginning to be around, really. You kind of finish school and you earn money.
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, it was an American concept first, teenage rebellion and stuff. But Pinky, Richard Attenborough's Pinky in 47, was kind of the first rebellious youth on British screen, really.
Yeah. They called it Young Scarface in America when it came out.
Yeah, which exactly shows you the kind of level of shock that it created, really.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
We're not so shocked in it now, of course, but I think we're putting yours in the 64. It is quite shocking, because you're so inured to kind of, you know, rebellious youth on screen, to sort of see it in a different setting, which is what Rowan's done, I think, with your film. For me, it really worked, and it kind of really brought the religious elements of the book that make it so torrid in a kind of Victorian way, as you're saying.
also there was more censorship in cinema in those days, whereas you could write more or less whatever you wanted to a certain extent. But so the book has darkness and violence that the film couldn't have. Although Richard Attenborough is very frightening in that, and it's very dark and violent as well.
And on any project that is set in a different time from the one that we are in right this moment, which of course are most, the downfall, of course, would be to play that period as we perceive it through film, because the censorship was such that if you watch a 50s movie that's set in its time, that's a version of a truth. It's not perhaps real life. So we very much tried to play it as real people who would have experienced what they had the access to experience in 1964, and not to let sort of 1964 film, for example, colour what we were doing.
Yeah. Pretty Woman's on the radio. Right? The Beatles are coming. Yeah.
What did you for accents? I mean, that was something I thought about, obviously, because neither of you are using your normal accent, which you are today, I think,
yes.
Unless you're really, really getting into
not
it. And as I know you, I thought, well, that's good. They're both kind of dissembling a bit with accents. How did you get those? Are they accents of the time? As you're talking about, you don't kind of look at 60s films to get the accents, but I mean, I don't know where else you'd get that vernacular from.
There's a great, I'm sure you've seen it, the series of documentaries that they did in the late 50s, I think. One of them's called We Are the Lambeth Boys.
Yeah.
Which was that Lindsay and, I think
it was Carol Rice and Indy Anderson.
Yeah, they did one of them, and it's about a boys' club after school, and these young men there. For me that was really helpful, because they talk about what they were interested in, and they have a way of talking, a way of walking. They talk about how much they spend on a suit and yeah. things, and that really helped me try and work out what boys were like then, you know.
Because we'd heard you do Northern before.
I've never done my own voice in a film, because that's Macclesfield.
Neither have I. Yeah, it's strange. That was also helpful for me in terms of vowels and consonants, but not particularly helpful in terms of slang, because Rose was incredibly self-protective, so didn't really allow herself. She's of a different time in so many ways, and that's one of the ways she happens to be of a different time.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I was obviously seeing Brighton Rock, and then Never Let Me Go, which is out very soon, which you're in a bit, not a lot, but almost unrecognisable, the two of you. You're Rose and I can't remember the name of your character in Never Let Me Go.
Chrissy.
She's only little. But then she's in a cafe as well. There's a pivotal scene in the cafe where you're sausage, egg and chips. And yes. And I just thought, oh, there she is in a cafe again. There's something about you and cafes, Andrea Risborough.
I've played a lot of parts. I mean, I know I'm just sort of coming to it, but still fresh, out of the oven, as they say. But only two of those parts have been in cafes.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't know.
So Wallace Simpson's not in a cafe.
No, Wallace won't be in a cafe. No, she won't.
Sam, it is
walking and smoking is my thing.
That's what you do. You're brilliant.
But I don't drink or smoke in this one.
But you're very good at walking and smoking.
Oh, he's great at walking.
Yes. Yeah. It's not easy, you know.
I don't have to talk at the same time.
One foot and then the other.
Yeah. One foot, right foot.
Now, the last time I wasn't the last time I saw you, but I saw you recently in America in the remake of 13. Well, 13.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Wait, when's that? Were we going to see that?
Well, I did. That was 2 years ago, and. I went home for Christmas this year, and I went into the local pub, and the landlord said, "Saw that 13." I was like, "How the hell have you seen it?" I was in it, and he picked it up on pirate DVD. So I'm ashamed to say that, although I didn't buy one, I have seen it.
You've seen it before, even the cut.
Well, if the landlord's seen it, then I'm going to bloody watch it.
Exactly what I'm looking for.
It's really good,
is it?
I mean, it's bleak as hell, but
that's what I'm expecting.
I thought it must be a stinker if it's been out 2 years and no one wants to watch. But I was really happy with it.
But it looked good on set when we were out there. I thought this is going to be really good.
Yeah, I think it is.
And we mentioned Wallace Simpson, so that's where we're going to see you next, Andrew. But you're off to Berlin as well to be a shooting star.
Yes. Sorry, that's funny, because I thought you were talking about Resistance.
Oh, with Michael Sheen.
Yeah. But because Berlin, although it's not set in Berlin, it's set amongst a pile of sheep shit in Wales in a Welsh mining village. That's not to say that Abergavenny Venny is not a beautiful place, which it is. But it was a very it's just the most glorious country. Every morning we drove to set, it was breathtaking. The light there, the everything, the rolling hills and valleys are Unbelievable.
You found a new hideaway.
So beautiful, so beautiful. But yes, that's a version of what might have happened had the Nazi invasion been successful in 1945, but told from the perspective of a small Welsh mining village.
He's going to get the pirate DVD.
Beautiful, beautiful Owen Shear's book, which has been adapted.
But you are going to Berlin Film Festival, you know.
But yes, apparently, back to the shoot, this star business, we were talking about this before, shooting star award thing.
Yeah, so you have to be one of Europe's great promising actresses.
Which is a lovely, lovely thing.
But he lives in... You still live in Berlin?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to show around?
Yeah. Na klar.
You're going to be fine. They're getting everywhere with that.
I'm hoping to see Sam and Alex and see the house.
Yeah.
So, well, congratulations on Brighton Rock. Love the clothes. Love the spirit. And I love the religion. We don't get much religion films these days.
No,
and it's quite refreshing to discuss it. Sam, Andrea, beautiful to see you. Congratulations on the film. I'm going to get myself a Vespa.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And following premieres in both Brighton and London, Brighton Rock is on a national release from this Friday, the 4th of February. No stranger to the Parker and the Vespa, Zan Brooks motors into the studio. Welcome, Zan.
Thank you, Jason.
This week we'll be looking at Nicole Kidman in Rabbit Hole, the Oscar-nominated Christian Bale in The Fighter, alongside Amy Adams and a whole host of Oscar nominees, and no stranger to Oscar nominations herself, Natalie Portman, making her directorial debut in New York, I Love You. But first, we'll talk about Brighton Rock, because I was at O'Reilly and Risborough Sandwich there, or the filling in one. Mm. How did the updating of the Graham Greene novel and the John Bolting film to 1964 go down with you?
It didn't really work for me. I think it's a very handsome film. He's a very talented visual director. All the pieces were kind of in place.
John Matheson doing the cinematography.
Cinematography and a great sense of Brighton. I mean, you know, which was one of the great bonuses of the original Bolting Brothers film, that sort of tangy salt and vinegar sense of tawdry, tatty Brighton, which is sort of largely preserved here, even though it's maybe a slightly more overblown and operatic.
Yeah, and even though much of it was shot in Eastbourne, I might just add.
It was, yeah. Apparently it's more preserved.
Brighton looks like crap, apparently.
There's a lot of Brightonians who listen to this.
No, I mean, it doesn't look like, but in terms of if you want it to look like 1960s,
It's not going to be that. I didn't believe in it at the end of the day. It felt sort of almost verging on high camp at times. Mm. It almost was like a sort of the West End musical of Brighton Rock without the songs.
Well, there was. It reminded me a bit of the Road to Perdition in certain places as well. There should have been like a dance. There was very balletic
they
kind
could
of
have
dance
had like show tunes. Like, what would it have been? You're Good and I'm Bad. That would have been a good song.
Zan, well, let's go to Rabbit Hole, talking of West End musicals. This was written by John Cameron Mitchell, adapting from an original stage play. He's, of course, the man who gave us Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
I loved Hedwig and the Angry Inch
very
much.
Easy to like than to say. And then he gave us Short Bus.
He did give a short bus, which I liked too.
No, I thought that was terrible.
Did you?
I wanted to never speak to him again.
Well, Hedwig I much preferred, but Short Bus was good.
No, I hated it. Pretentious swingers. But now he's back with Rabbit Hole, which features Nicole Kidman and Aaron Eckhart as a married couple, but they are grieving over the death of their child, who's been killed by a boy called Jason. No relation.
I liked this so much. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Do you think they're real?
Parallel universes. I think it's basic science. You know, if space is infinite, then everything's possible.
So somewhere out there, I'm what? I'm making pancakes? Or I'm at a water park?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both, you know, whatever. There are tons of yous out there, and there's tons of me's floating around.
Yeah. And this is just the sad version of us.
Yeah, I guess.
But there's other versions.
There he is showing Nicole Kidman his comic book as she kind of gets to grips with the death of her child. It's obviously a depressing setup. Is it a depressing movie?
It's not really depressing so much as tasteful and a little bit one note. It's a kind of like sustained one note on a piano that goes for sort of an hour and a half.
Like Jocelyn Pook's score, Two Eyes Wide Shut.
Exactly like that one. I guess it's a sort of bereavement drama in the mode of, say, In the Bedroom or the Son's Room. They're all about rooms.
There's a lot of rooms in this, aren't there? They live in a very nice house, basically.
Yeah.
I love a bit of property porn in
a
the
bit
movie.
Of property porn is never amiss. And a bit of Nicole Kidman in sort of frosty glacial mode is always good. I always prefer her in those kind of roles, like in The Others, say, or Birth. She's really good when she's basically kind of reining it all back in.
I'd love to see her and Colin Firth together.
It would be kind of like a vacuum, wouldn't it?
They're both straining. So there's a bit where Nicole Kidman in a bowling alley has a real go at her mum, played by Diane Wiest, and her neck strains and there's all this stuff going on. You think, my God, she's going to pop, poor thing.
She's
all
great
that Botox
at that.
Is going to kind of fall off her.
She's way better at that than when she's being extrovert and sexy.
Yeah.
And so it is a good performance from her. I think possibly when she produces it as well, and it's done, she obviously took a huge pay cut to make it.
Do you think so?
It's got a budget of like $5 million. I mean, she spends that on pants, I've heard.
Smacks. What are they called? Those ones that keep you, Spanks.
I wouldn't know.
You really wouldn't know.
I'm not wearing any at this moment.
That is obvious.
But I think that probably this was sort of seen as more of a kind of an Oscar contender than perhaps it's going.
Yeah, well, she got her nomination.
She's got a nomination. But I don't think she's quite.
No,
in
it's
the top
not
of
one
field.
Of those. It's almost one of those roles that you think, yes, it's an Oscar role because you can hear it's going to come, but she actually doesn't give it all that much.
No.
She kind of does less on it. Perhaps more would have in a way kind of worked something.
Yeah.
I was a bit unmoved by it, strangely. Given that it's so moving, it should be so moving. I don't know if there was a restraint there or if it was the kind of...
It's a strange film for Cameron Mitchell to do.
Yeah.
Whether you like him or hate him, he does these very sort of flamboyant films. And this is sort of showing that he can do something else, something slightly more coffee table and tasteful.
Yeah.
But because of that, it just felt like it was a veneer.
But there's still this... I think the reason I didn't really like it is because this kid has with his comic book, the rabbit hole comic book, which is... We spend a lot
which
of time.
She sort of is drawn to.
She thinks
to.
It's a beautiful piece of work. Yeah. And in fact, they gave me a copy of it.
Oh, did they?
They've done the
did
press
you think it was a beautiful piece
no,
of work?
No, I threw it away immediately. Well, I didn't. I will put it on eBay at one point, but if the film is any good at all, well, it's not. So, but they kept kind of, John Cameron, which was like, in Hedwig, there were these kind of, you know, graphically illustrated bits. In Short Bus, there was that kind of papier-mâché thing of New York going on. And in this one, we kept having to look at this kid's comic book.
Yeah, but you're not a fan of the comic book,
well,
though.
I'm not a fan of the comic book, but also it's got nothing to do with the film.
No,
I'm like, with Nicole grieving for her baby. And then this idiot who can't drive, who runs a kid over, goes, well, here's my comic book, that's really good. It completely diluted the drama because it had to show the bleeding comic book.
Yeah, less comic books in films, I think.
That's the motto for coming out of a rabbit hole. Talking of rabbits, I'm going to a zoo now for Ninette.
Ninette, en 1969 à Bornéo. Arrivée à la ménagerie du Jardin des Plantes le 16 juin 1972. Mère de Tubo.
Elle a 40 ans, tu te rends compte?
Oui.
Le même âge que ton papa.
That's the voice of a French mother there explaining how old Ninette is. 40 years old. Ninette is an orangutan.
She looks good on it.
She doesn't look bad, 40. She's
born, better
the
than
same,
I do.
Born in the same year as me, I noticed, about the film. And she's in the Jardin des Plantes Zoo in Paris, and she's the subject of Nicolas Philibert's new documentary. He's the guy, of course, who won, was Oscar nominated for Etre et Avoir, story of looking at a nursery. Great film.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Absolutely fantastic
it?
Film. Sort of the same detachment here employed just to look at Ninette. I mean, the thing we should say about it, and it is 67 minutes of an orangutan in behind some glass.
Yeah, it's 67 minutes visiting the zoo.
Yeah,
and specifically,
well, not the rest of the zoo.
No, specifically Nanette's bit of of the zoo. Yeah, and yet it's utterly fascinating,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's isn't really it? Good. I mean, it's really good. It's all you're doing is staring through the glass at. This monkey.
So why is that really good? How come is that really?
Well, I guess it's monkey as mirror, isn't it? I mean, I think that's what Nicolas Philibert is trying to imply, that in looking into Ninette, we also look into ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, the start of it goes on her, it starts on her eyelashes, on these big eyes, which are, you know, like a very beautiful pair of eyes. Mm. She got Betty Davis eyes.
She has got Betty Davis eyes, but the face and body of a monkey.
Yes, we got Betty Davis's body as well, actually. Late Betty Davis. The thing is, would this have worked if it was a hippopotamus?
No, I suspect not. Although, you know, why not give that a go? See if it works.
I think, you know,
throughout history, and obviously there'll be some creationists hopping up and down at this point, throughout history, I think we've maybe identified with the monkey as us.
But there's a whole kind of anthropomorphic thing we foist on in it, looking at her, like all those kids that you hear.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing. It reminded me a little bit of those experiments they do, you know, with where they show a close-up of somebody looking completely blank, play some music under it, and you say, oh, he's really happy, or no, he's about to commit suicide, that guy. And so we're projecting, we're investing this monkey with all of our stuff, basically. And so it's a film about captivity and how we cope with captivity and what we do with our lives.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, I mean, it kind of, that, well, there's all that, and you start thinking the zoo's good things, well, they're not good things, and poor Ninette, she's had this. But then she's had a kind of quite human life. She's almost had a sort of soap opera life, four husbands,
and she's outlived them all.
Yeah, I mean, she's some kind of like soap character.
Yeah.
And then there's this
kind of weird hint of incest.
There's a hint of bestiality as well. Some zookeeper sort of saying, well, I preferred hugging hugs from Ninette, they were the strongest. And I was like, all right, calm down. And all this is off camera, of course, you just hear it in the see it in the subtitles. It's interesting, I've never seen it without subtitles, because that would be really weird, because at the moment you're looking at the net and also reading subtitles. There must be there's a print,
and different languages as well. It's different, you know, different nationalities
Japanese
of the people who are visiting.
Yeah, the visitors.
It's a hard sell. Go stare at a monkey through the glass for 67 minutes. But if you're going to stare at a monkey through the glass for 67 minutes, this is the best 67 minutes of doing that you'll ever have.
If the poster were big enough to put that on, Dan, that would walk onto it. Zan, we'll move to New York, I Love You, which you haven't seen.
I haven't seen. Tell me about New York, I Love You.
Do you remember Paris, I Love You?
I do remember that, yeah. I'm waiting for when they can do Froom, I Love You.
Yes, well, that would be very short, I think. New York is big enough to take it. I think that with Paris, Je T'aime, of course, had 20 arrondissements, all with their own characters, so they all got a director, a kind of well-known auteur, and they set love stories in each of them. They've done the sort of same with New York, I Love You. Lots of different directors, not so many well-defined areas, rather patchy, but there is one. I'm going to take you, I think it's a hotel, it's uptown. Julie Christie is in there. She's being serviced by a hobbledehoy porter played by Shia LaBeouf.
I was hoping it would snow. Then the street is quiet. The world goes quiet.
I don't think there is snow.
You're not American?
No. No, we're not so many of us American in this hotel.
It's one of the things I love best about New York. Everyone came from somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I hope you will be very comfortable here. Please go down if you need anything.
There are no flowers. Is it possible to have flowers in the room? Violets?
Shia LaBeouf giving it accent and limp and everything. And I think that's the thing with short films, is that, you know, there's not much to go on as a character. So Shia LaBeouf's coming along, so I can do him with a limp and an accent, because really there's nothing to do here, so I'm going to do all this. And you're like, stop acting.
Yeah, it's the workshop scenario.
Everyone's acting. In fact, that clip we heard from that film, John Hurt's part of it. Anthony Minghella wrote it and Shekhar Kapoor directed it. But yeah, I'm thinking, well, great, New York, I Love You. You should have Wes Anderson, Woody Allen. Yeah. And then you think, well, of course, they did that Martin Scorsese
New York Stories,
New York Stories in 89.
I kind of like that.
But I kind of like two of those out.
Two of those.
No one likes the
Coppola
stuff. No one likes that. But they don't have those people in it at all. They've got sort of really strange kind of mix of people and a very strange mix of stories, and they just sort of plonk you in it.
I wonder how these things are developed. They almost are like these little kind of off-cut vanity projects by people who've got like 2 weeks on their hands.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Let's just do that. It'd
strange
be fun.
Enough, the best one was by Brett Ratner.
Really?
Rush Hour.
You put that on the poster.
Yeah, I know. That's got the best bit as well. It was a coming-of-age story, losing your virginity on prom night in Central Park. I thought for a minute it was Todd Solondz. I thought, this is really weird.
Sounds
this
perfect, Todd Solondz.
Yeah, and there's a really good punchline. And then it said at the end it was Brett Ratner. I had to rewind and go, is that really Brett Ratner?
Maybe this is Brett Ratner showing his dark side.
Well, maybe it's a sign of things to come from Brett Ratner.
Well, then that's very intriguing.
I look forward to that. But that is all that's intriguing.
Is this like a kind of unofficial franchise? Are we going to get kind
I think there's a London
Stockport,
I Love You.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know about Stockport, right. But I think London. Yeah, and I don't know where you do what you do in London. I think that the pitfalls of New York, I Love You, show you what you should avoid in London. But it would be great to see London directors do all this stuff. But there's a couple of Japanese directors in this one. It's all a bit
But that's New York, there, the melting pot.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was the idea. Yeah, it just doesn't really work. Zan, we shall now move to the climax of our review section, The Fighter.
The final round, this.
Many ding-ding, The Fighter. It has been hailed as the new Rocky. It's been hailed as the best boxing action film since Raging Bull. It stars Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale as Dicky and Mickey, two brothers warring over the ring. One that wants to be a world champion. One thought he was going to be a world champion, but succumbed to crack addiction.
I just want to tell you to face myself. I got no management. Mickey keeps my training now. It's going good.
Yeah, I got you fighting Alfonso Sanchez. HBO's invested in a Mexican, Mike. Wake up.
I didn't think they were going to be invested in me.
They don't care if he kills you. Mike Thelma did it. He's using you like a stepping stone for Sanchez.
Why can't you just shut up and be happy for me? I spent the last 10 years of my life in bad fights set up by you and Alice. I finally got a good thing going for me, and you can't be happy for me? Why?
What's your plan? How are you going to fight Sanchez?
I need to talk about that.
What's your plan?
I am not here to talk about that.
Yes, you are. You gotta run against this guy. Let him punch himself out. Take him to the body, right? Get inside. Switch stances like you're gonna work his right. Hit him on the left.
You ain't me. All right? You can't be me. You had a hard enough time being you when you had your chance, and that's why you're in here. All right? I'll fight Sanchez the way I fight.
I'm talking about the way you fight, you moron.
Christian Bale, Oscar-nominated. Amy Adams, Oscar-nominated. Melissa Leo, Oscar-nominated. The film, Oscar-nominated. Poor old Mark Wahlberg, who produced it and kind of went into training for it, doesn't get a mention, actually, poor lad.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? And I found Christian Bale's kind of acceptance speech at the Globes a little bit kind of patronising, wasn't it? It was like, you're playing the role that nobody notices, Mark, but you're good in it, but no one notices. And they noticed me, didn't notice you.
You could not notice Christian Bale in
no,
this.
No, it's all the bells and whistles, isn't it? It's the real actor's turn. Yeah. And he's great in
it. I really liked
it. It's fantastic. He's the sort of the live wire crack addict brother who once sort of knocked down Sugar Ray Leonard, or maybe Sugar Ray Leonard slipped, but you know, who knows?
Yeah.
But he had his shot at glory and then it all went to hell. And Mark Wahlberg plays Mickey, who's the welterweight kind of contender.
And does it quite well, I think. But no one really notices him.
No one notices him.
It's really odd. Because everyone else is acting their socks off in this film.
Yeah.
I noticed it was produced, executive produced by Darren Aronofsky, but directed by David O. Russell, as if Aronofsky went, well, I did The Wrestler.
Yeah,
I think
that was the case.
I want to do some dancing now, otherwise people are going to think I'm really butch. So I'll produce this one, give you some gloves. And is it The Wrestler, but with gloves on?
Yeah, it kind of is. And in the tradition of all great boxing movies, you know, most notably Raging Bull, it's kind of about the family cauldron that these pugilists come out of, and the way that the violence in the ring has a way of sort of spilling over into the violence in the living room. So you've got Melissa Leo as the sort of the harpy mum who has this sort of sorority of daughters of all of their big hair, and there's lots of kind of arguments and punch-ups on sort of front porches.
Yeah, it's a kind of big fat gypsy wedding kind of family that they've got.
It's all
there.
Set in Lowell in Massachusetts, this real sort of blue-collar neighbourhood. Sort of that area around Boston is really becoming the go-to area for certain filmmers.
The Town recently, for which Jeremy Renner seems to
have gotten. And The Departed, too, was also set around there.
There's my Boston accent.
And, you know, I guess, you know, when we're reviewing films, you have to confess a weakness. And I have a weakness for these kind of films, these big, actually, slightly corny.
Do you like boxing movies?
I do like boxing movies.
Yeah. I love a boxing movie. I like boxing, and I like boxing movies.
Yeah, it's a shameful thing to admit, but there's something utterly gripping about it.
David O. Russell, interesting director, I think. I really enjoyed
Three
Kings.
I think he's brilliant.
Yeah, but did you see I Heart Huckabees?
I did see I Heart Huckabees, but you know,
that
a brilliant director
a brilliant
is going to... The definition of a brilliant director is that they're going to really overreach and fall flat on their face. Three Kings I thought was fantastic.
Yeah,
Flirting with Disaster I thought was great.
That was a good film.
Right back to Spanking the Monkey, sort of back in the mid-90s. Mm. This is a more conventional film. It's not really trying for anything. But within that, he is a very busy, astute, competent director.
Yeah. The Fighter, then, briefly, I mean, I thought it was really enjoyable.
I thought it was great, really actually.
Yeah. Could it win Best Picture?
No, I don't think so.
I'd love to see Colin Firth against Christian Bale and Nicole Kidman. I think you know, the Christian Bale's is the real performance here.
I think it is. I think he will win Best Supporting.
Yeah, I think so. I think he'll beat Jeffrey Rush. Thank God for that. Got to get a dig in. Zan.
Well, there'll be many more opportunities for digs, Jason.
Yes, there will. Zan, The Fighter, is that our film of the week?
It is mine, yeah.
Yeah,
that and the net, I think.
Yes.
See, that has a double bill.
That would work.
Mm.
In some
both studies of tortured souls in captivity.
Absolutely. Zan, thank you very much indeed. The gloves are off, so if you want to read more of Zan's writings and watch some of his videos, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Miriam?
Barney, this has to stop.
You got my flowers?
Yeah, I got the flowers, I got the gifts. Every week it's something else. I don't know where to start with how inappropriate this all is.
Why don't you just skip ahead from where I'm annoying and inappropriate to where I'm charming and endearing?
No, because you're a married man and I won't be involved with you in any way.
No, I'm sorry, I know. Why don't we talk about it over lunch?
I could be in New York tomorrow.
Are you listening to me?
Every word.
Really? Well, words matter. Actions matter. If you want people to take you seriously, then act accordingly. Understand? What am I saying?
Be great and act as you haven't thought.
Well, yes, exactly. I have to go, so stop this nonsense and focus on your marriage.
Well, I'm just so happy that you called. Thank you, Miriam.
Goodbye, Barney.
A scene there from Barney's version, a hugely likable comedy based on Mordecai Richler's novel and set mostly in the 1970s. It's the story of Barney Panofsky, played by Paul Giamatti, a hard-drinking, chain-smoking TV producer, and his complicated emotional life. In particular, his love of Miriam, played superbly by British actress Rosamund Pike. Rosamund may have established her on-screen career in costume dramas such as Pride and Prejudice, but over the last few years, she's slowly and subtly carved out a Hollywood profile for herself in films like Fracture alongside Ryan Gosling and the sci-fi thriller Surrogates opposite Bruce Willis. All this was achieved whilst retaining a place at the high table of British independent cinema, putting in eye-catching performances in hits such as An Education and Made in Dagenham. But with Barney's version, Pike gets to flex her acting muscles in new and exciting ways, pulling off her most finessed comic performance to date. So when I met up with Rosamund, I began by asking her how she went about building up her character, Miriam, and capturing the nuances of an independent woman in 1970s America.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think you start listening to the music. I mean, she was working for a jazz radio station at the time, you know, and I'd done a bit of... I played that a character in Fugitive Pieces who was very sort of lefty and into jazz and into sort of Marshall McLuhan and who died recently. Did you see that?
Marshall McLuhan did, yes, not your character.
No, sorry, that Marshall McLuhan died. Yeah, that's what I mean. So I was sort of, I remember reading all about that and reading all about Canadian politics of that time and Trudeau and all that. So, you know, some of that tallied in with Barney's version. So I sort of, a bit like in Made in Dagenham, I'd done a lot of research for an education, so my homework was sort of done already, which helps.
Yeah, absolutely. Because she, I mean, she's a great... creature, obviously, and she kind of wanders in. What I love about...
I'm glad you called me a creature. I've always wanted to be a creature.
Oh, really? But yes. She prowls, doesn't she?
There's a book. I know, there's this wonderful book by... what's his name? Who wrote Revolutionary Road? Richard Yates. Mm. And there's another book called Young Hearts Crying. And this man meets a girl in it who is described as a creature. She's a fascinating creature. And he thinks... And his wife, this man's wife, thinks, oh, I'll never be a creature. You know, she feels inferior to this other woman because she's a creature and she knows that she's never going to be considered a creature. So I knew what she felt, so I'm glad you call me a creature. Oh, dear, I'm digressing.
No, it's good. It's a compliment to your acting because she sort of slinks in, she's panther-like in a way, and she does... You know, she steals the scene. She kind of steals his heart at a wedding. I mean, interestingly, it's a good Jewish wedding.
Yes.
And he comes to the blonde Shiksa, and she's dark.
Except she's dark.
Yeah, but she's dark. But you know, in my female imagination, all Shiksas are blonde.
So, yeah. I know. There was a big discussion as to whether they should keep me blonde or make me dark. I mean, I thought she should definitely have dark hair because Miriam in the novel has dark hair. But it would have been quite strange because I would have had been blonde. I would have been the only blonde woman in that room, which would have been sort of, you know, quite powerful, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it would have made you stand out.
Yeah. Where were we before?
Where I was, you were stealing. About. You were stealing.
I don't think I did much stealing in this film. I don't think I did any stealing at all.
You stole his heart.
I stole his heart. Yeah. Yes, I did steal his heart. But I think, you know, Miriam is the sort of opposite of a scene stealer. She's a very sort of quiet presence, which in some ways is hard, you know, because you can't. You know, it was always an exercise in not pushing anything, not asking to be liked. You know, so many women in films are asked, begging the audience to like them and love them. Mm. And Miriam can't do any of that because she's just so damn centred and secure and grounded, really.
Why do you think it is that little aperçu that you come up with there that women are so... Do you think it's because they're not getting big scenes, so they only get a few scenes?
I don't think it's necessarily the actresses. No. I think it's just the way the characters are written. You know, it's all about sort of being sexy or sort of flirting with an audience or, you know, that I think people fear that a woman who's just very... sort of, you know, uncrazy or un, you know, she's not a dramatic soul, Miriam, at all, is she? And they, people fear that that won't be interesting. I mean, I think there were times that I feared it wouldn't be interesting as well, to be honest. And then I found, you know, that my fears were allayed because people have really warmed to her. But she's not an expected character.
Do you think that much of that comes from, and when I say scene stealing, I don't mean, it's always a good critical turn of phrase, you steal a scene, but actually as an actor, it's always sort of a bad thing because you're supposed to be generous, of course, and you're not supposed to kind of steal scenes and stuff. However, in films like An Education, in films like Made in Dagenham, you have a few scenes which you have to make your mark in, and you did, and you did them beautifully, and they're sort of comic turns in a way. Is that what you mean when you're, when you then get Miriam in Barney's version, who is a slightly, you know, you have to downplay her, that is a sort of an odd reflex for you to suddenly be on camera and not do it?
It's a different challenge, and in a way I suppose Miriam in some ways is more of a leading lady, you know, where, you know, as a supporting actor, you know, your business is to serve the lead. So in An Education, you know, it was how Helen fitted in to that world and how, you know, and I said to Dominic at the time, Dominic Cooper, that we are interesting as a couple and what Jenny, Carey Mulligan's character, sees in us. You know, I thought Helen was probably one of the first women to go on the pill and probably their sort of sexual power as a couple was had an impact on the film and impact on her and the way she thought about herself and stuff. And then when you're into playing a more leading role, it's, in a way, you have to, you do less supporting, so you know you can just sort of be a bit more.
What you're doing right now is balancing a flourishing film career, which we have only sort of see every now and then for a week, and then but you've also doing your stage work as well. Have you got more of that coming up? Because that you always seem to be, you disappear off from film, go and do some stage, and you come back a stronger actress.
Oh, that's nice, Jason.
It's all right, you can pay me later.
Yeah. I think definitely there was a bit of growing going on last year because I played Hedda Gabler, which definitely, you know, stretched the muscles, the emotional muscles. It's like you get in tune, you get very in tune with your emotions doing stage, and they become very readily available because you have to contact them night after night, and you sort of don't worry about it. You just trust that it'll all appear and it'll all come and happen in the moment, you know, and I think on film, it helps with the pressures of film because often, you know, you have to come to an emotional moment and you don't know what point of the day it's going to come. You know, at least on stage, you know that at 7:30 the curtain's going to go up, so you can gear your whole day around that. But in film, sometimes, you know, you're ready to go and you have to wait 2 hours. And I think theatre sort of trains you to be able to get in touch with everything.
I've got to ask you before, you're talking about muscles, and I, only because the big poster of your film is there, and there's the scene with you in your pants.
Oh, yes.
Yes, when you, which you flex your pant, you flex your bottom.
Do I?
A little bottom thing in the film to attract him.
Jeez.
And, well, it's kind of when you see someone you know kind of flexing their bum on screen, you think, I didn't know she could do that. That's rather clever.
Twitching my arse.
Did you train?
I think that must have just been a reflex. Really? The sight of Paul in his boxer shorts, to be honest.
Looked like Natalie Portman went through months of training to be a ballerina. I thought you must have done that.
I know, I was actually auditioning for Black Swan, didn't get the part, so I got to sort of just flex my arse muscles in Barney's version instead. I'm glad that was a sort of subtlety that I didn't intend, but you picked up on. Maybe that's why they went for the shot. Well, I'm glad it made it to the poster anyway, because at least I can look back in later years.
It's more attractive than Dustin Hoffman's moustache.
I think I said that it couldn't be on the book cover, though. I thought they can sell, the book is good enough. Mordecai Richter is a good enough writer and doesn't need my arse to sell his wonderful novel.
Well, that's an epitaph for him, and it's brilliant. Roz, absolutely beautiful to see you. Loved you in Barney's version. Loved it. And, you know, not coming to my Jewish wedding. You'll cause havoc. And thanks to the lovely Rosamund Pike for her full title. Barney's version is presently on UK-wide release, and it's well worth catching. And that brings us to a close for this edition of Film Weekly. Now, if you were to join us on Facebook under Film Weekly Fans, then you were in with a chance to win one of three sets of Latin DVDs tied to last week's interview with Javier Bardem. We asked you what film won Bardem his 2008 Supporting Actor Oscar, and the answer was, of course, No Country for Old Men, playing Anton Chigurh. We had lots of responses, but the winners are Ulrika Zauer from Berlin, Guten Tag, Ulrika, Laura Shearer from the UK. All right, Laura. And Steve Burge, again, from here in the UK, in Somerset, according to his Facebook. All right, Steve. We had loads of entries, so thanks to all of you. Do keep an eye on that Film Weekly fans page because we have regular giveaways and they're very enticing. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is taken from the soundtrack to New York, I Love You. It's by the Boudos Band. But until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.